You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a proposed bill would expand insurance coverage to include adaptive wheelchair technology that allows its user to stand or be elevated. We'll find out more from the bill's sponsor in the state legislature. First, the U.S. Senate passed a revamped trade agreement today with the U.S., Mexico, and Canada, sending it on to the president. This follows another big trade deal for the Trump administration.
Today, we take a momentous step, one that has never been taken before with China, toward a future of fair and reciprocal trade as we sign phase one of the historic trade deal between the United States and China. Together, we are righting the wrongs of the past and delivering a future of economic justice and security for American workers, farmers, and families.
The phase one trade deal signed by Trump and China's vice premier would appear to pause the ongoing trade war and back and forth tariffs from both countries on billions of dollars worth of goods going back more than a year, though many of those tariffs will stay in effect. Megan Casella is a trade reporter for Politico. Megan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
The president has called this agreement a momentous step, one that's never been taken before with China. Looking at the content of this this phase one trade deal, how big a deal is this?
Well, I mean, there's a number of different ways to look at this. This is certainly a achievement for the president and his administration, something they've been working on for several months now. It will go a long way towards, one, scoring political points, showing a political win that the president is able to make some of these deals he's been saying he can make. It also restabilizes the relationship a little bit by sort of pausing these trade tensions that had been escalating for a few months. And, you know, there's an agreement at this point not to impose more tariffs and a commitment to look at removing some of those that are in place. But that's sort of where these things get sticky, because it doesn't remove so many of those tariffs that have been in place for 2 years now that have been affecting American farmers and consumers. And it also doesn't get at the heart of the issues that really launched this trade war in the first place. I mean, the Trump administration wanted to look at China's industrial policies and its use of subsidies, and those issues are not addressed in this phase one. That's part of phase two.
Let's get into what is in phase one. You mentioned no more tariffs, no more new tariffs. What other changes happen in this phase one deal?
The largest part of this, and the most concrete really, is this agreement for China to boost its purchases of American products over the next 2 years at a level of $200 billion. So that's a lot of that is agriculture. There's also energy, some manufactured goods, and that sort of thing. So China's really going to boost those purchases. There's also some new requirements and restrictions centered on currency manipulation, an agreement not to engage in those practices. There's also some restrictions on technology transfer and operating in China, and some new regulations for American payment card companies like MasterCard and Visa that they're also pleased by. There's also an enforcement mechanism, and so it remains to be seen, of course, how well it will work, but there's an agreement from both sides that if either one is deemed not to be living up to its commitments, that they could then impose more tariffs as punishment.
That commitment to buy more stuff, is that more stuff as compared to right now after 2 years of tariffs, or how does that compare to what it would have been without tariffs? I've seen some people try to tackle the math on that, and I don't fully understand how it shakes out.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to really know at this point, since people are looking at different numbers and sometimes it's comparing apples to oranges. But that's the hard part, is that, yes, this is a massive increase in purchases, particularly of agricultural goods, and that'll really help the farmers. But, you know, I'm asking everyone I talk to, is this really any better than we would have been in 2016 or 2017 before any of this started? And a lot of the perspective that I'm hearing is that, no, we're not even really back to square one where we were, especially because, you know, not only because of the purchasing levels and the fact that farmers had been missing out on those sales for 2 years, but also because so many of these tariffs are still remaining in place. And it'll be difficult for China to meet the levels that it's promising to commit.
Let's talk about those tariffs that are still in place and the scope of those tariffs. What do we still have in effect, even if this phase one is fully implemented?
We still have tariffs in effect on roughly $370 billion worth of goods that we import from China. So partly because of this phase one deal, those tariffs do not yet cover some of the things that could be most substantial for consumers. Some of those high price items coming from China, like iPhones and televisions, those do not have tariffs on them. But so many other things do. It's clothing, it's footwear, it's everyday household goods as well. And so, you know, manufacturers and businesses, other importers have for so long been trying to swallow that added tariff increase and not pass it on to the consumer. But the longer they stay in place, we're already hearing more and more stories of companies saying, you know, I have to increase prices. I have no other choice because it's affecting my bottom line.
But as you say, these might be the products where we might see a few cents in increases in low cost products here. It's not that appliance that suddenly costs $100 more. So the consumer may not notice the prices going up.
Certainly. Yeah. I mean, and that's why the administration has worked pretty hard to shield some of those big ticket items, because those are much more noticeable and much more immediate for consumers. These lower ticket items, you might not notice right away, but then again, you know, things could start to trickle up. And it's also, you know, I would be remiss if I didn't mention that importers also import a lot of what we call intermediate products, which means that, you know, it's a small item, but it's going in, it's then assembled in the U.S. into a bigger item that costs more money. So if a lot of those intermediate items are starting to increase in prices, then overall, the good itself might be substantially more expensive after a while.
Talking to Megan Casella, trade reporter for Politico, about this phase one deal reached between the U.S. and China after a couple of years of escalating tariffs. Megan, phase one kind of hints that there might be a phase two somewhere. Is there any indication of what and when something like that might be negotiated?
There's not a lot of clarity on that yet. And that's where a lot of the criticism that we're hearing about this deal is coming from. You know, there was a big ceremony at the White House yesterday. There's a lot of, you know, victorious exclamations today about what the administration has achieved. But if all of the tough issues are on phase two, and we don't yet have a clear path forward about when that's going to happen, there's no indication yet of when those talks might start. And of course, not when they might conclude. And even the president himself has started to say that that might not conclude until after the 2020 election. Now, longtime China observers often say that, you know, Beijing is really, really good at making promises and not following through. So they might just try to string along the U.S. until the end of this president's administration, whether that's in 1 year or 5 years.
Let's get into one of those tough issues that you touched on earlier, the concern about China's industrial policy. What are the criticisms that come from other countries when it comes to how China, the central government there, manages and works with industry?
There's a whole lot of criticism, but sort of one of the central points is about China's use of government subsidies and the billions of dollars worth of money that they give to their state-owned enterprises to help them compete with other, you know, private enterprises around the world. And the argument is that that use of such heavy subsidies makes it much harder for other companies to compete in the same way, that the playing field isn't level. And that's just, you know, the word I actually searched in the 86-page text of the agreement that was released yesterday. The word subsidy doesn't even appear in that text. And so that's something that's really been kicked down the road a little bit.
And this is just a fundamentally different economic philosophy, right? This is how China wants to run its economy. And it doesn't seem like something they'd want to give up anytime soon. I don't know.
Of course not. Yeah, this is sort of how, you know, the country has been built and how its enterprises have developed and that sort of thing. And so getting China to totally change its entire system, of course, is a very tough issue, especially when it's something that Beijing doesn't really want to change. And so that's part of where, you know, while these goals that the Trump administration has laid out of what it wants to change in China, it's shared by Democrats and Republicans. And it's also goals that are shared with many, if not all, of the U.S.'s trading partners. But, you know, they're going to have to come up with some sort of a creative approach to finally get Beijing to start making some changes they've been resisting for years.
What criticism I've seen of this deal is that, okay, if you're getting a commitment from China to say we're going to purchase X hundred billions of dollars of U.S. products, that means you are playing into, you're supporting that centralized state planned economy by saying, okay, yeah, the Chinese government is making a commitment on behalf of these industries to buy our stuff.
Exactly. Yeah, it's interesting when, you know, the idea of a free trade deal is to sort of allow markets compete the way they would, allow consumers to purchase, you know, what they want and that sort of thing, and to let it all flow freely without trade barriers like tariffs or anything else. But again, yeah, I've seen that criticism and heard it with people I've talked to as well, that, you know, if you're mandating that China buy a certain amount of these goods, especially if the level of what they're supposed to be purchasing is higher than China itself can easily purchase, then you're almost asking the state to intervene there and asking the government to sort of step in and meet some of these commitments.
Now, we've heard about some criticism of this deal in the Trump administration. That said, it's not like past administrations or anybody has had a magic solution to difficulties with trade with China, right?
Of course not. Yeah, this is something that's been going on for years and years, that the U.S. has sort of had these issues. You know, one of the criticisms we hear, though, is that because of the Trump administration's really aggressive approach, they have imposed all these tariffs for so long. You know, some critics say there's two arguments here, I guess I should say. One is the case for incrementalism and saying, oh, of course, the Trump administration is right to lock in whatever progress we can get and call it phase one and then keep working. And others say, why would we trade away all of that hard-earned leverage and remove tariffs and other pressures prematurely without getting Beijing to change the practices that we care about the most?
One of the most important things about this deal between the U.S. and China is that it's a deal between the U.S. and China, not done via any kind of world organization, via something like the Trans-Pacific Partnership. How important, how significant do you think it is that this is just straight up bilateral negotiations between these two countries?
I think the hardest thing there is one of the biggest criticisms that we've always heard of the Trump administration's approach, because as I mentioned, the goals are widely supported, but the approach, taking this unilateral approach, there's some skepticism that it will ever work. You know, the U.S. is a very powerful country and a powerful economy, but working by itself, it can't pressure China the same way that it could if it were working in concert with many of its allies. So with the TPP, as you mentioned, that was the Obama administration's way of saying, we're going to sort of box in China by uniting all of these dozen countries. We're uniting those economies so that they can be a counterweight to China, because together they're much more powerful than anyone would be individually.
Now, phase two, kind of shrouded in mystery. We don't know what that could be or when it could happen. But what are you going to watch for next with this phase one deal to see what kind of impact it has, whether it's enforceable, that kind of thing?
We're really going to have to see how it's implemented. And notably, Chinese officials spoke yesterday at the signing ceremony about the steps forward. They were focused only on implementation. They were not mentioning phase two yet. So that's really where we're looking. We're going to see if China really is ramping up those purchases of ag and other goods. We're going to see, you know, what those buying levels look like. We're going to see if some of this negative talk we've seen has gone away. And only if and only if phase one gets fully implemented and we're seeing the purchasing levels increase and, you know, no messing with currency valuation or anything like that, that's when we'll likely see phase two talks really take off in earnest. And so the president, Trump, has said a couple of times now that he plans to go to Beijing at some point in the not too distant future, I believe is how he's framed it. But there's no set dates for that. And China hasn't yet confirmed the trip. So we'll be looking to see if that happens, too.
A lot to watch out for. Megan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Megan Casella reports on trade for Politico. We talked to her today about phase one of a new trade agreement signed yesterday between the U.S. and China. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, lawmakers are considering a new resolution to limit the president's ability to wage military action against Iran. We'll talk to a legal expert about the powers that Congress and the executive branch have when it comes to making war. First, State Representative Jimmy Anderson wants to put more power into the hands of those using wheelchairs by expanding Badger Care coverage to include more adaptive wheelchair technology. Representative Anderson is a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 47th Assembly District. That includes Fitchburg. Representative Anderson, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me today.
I'm not super familiar, first of all, with these different kind of wheelchair technologies. What kind of things are you talking about in this legislation?
So what this basically does is it allows individuals with you know, different kinds of typically spinal cord injuries who need access to different kinds of standing equipment to get access to it through our state Badger Care program.
Yeah, tell us a little more about these kind of wheelchairs that do this standing technology. Who would benefit from this? What kind of medical help does this give them?
Yeah, so for people that have spinal cord injuries that spend a lot of time either in a sitting or laying down position, it could create things like pressure sores or could create other kinds of bone density issues. And so these standing wheelchairs allows people to get in kind of elevated positions that relieve pressure and provide a lot of other benefits to things like kidney function, heart function. It's just an all-around a really great piece of technology that allows people with disabilities to be able to live fuller lives. And most importantly, as people tend not to know, is that pressure ulcers are the number one things that kill individuals in wheelchairs. And so this standing technology helps alleviate that problem.
As things are now, if there's someone who needs one of these, maybe there's a doctor who says, yes, this is a medical necessity, what is the state of affairs with their coverage? Do people get any kind of coverage for this right now?
So, right, sometimes there is coverage provided. I think what ends up happening is that when someone goes in and gets an evaluation for a wheelchair, for example, like when I went in and got in my wheelchair, I had to get seen by a doctor who got, then I got to see a physical therapist who then pointed me to a wheelchair technology specialist, and all of those people end up working in coordination to measure you for your wheelchair to make sure that everything is 100% what you need. The problem ends up happening is that when those individuals approve you for the necessity of, for example, standing technology or elevating technology, the insurance company can then go in and say, you know, we don't believe that you need this. We don't think that it's medically necessary. For myself, for example, I couldn't articulate why I needed elevating technology, having never been disabled, never been in a wheelchair before. And I ended up getting my wheelchair elevating technology denied. I rolled into a elevator for the first time and realized I couldn't raise up to reach the buttons to get to my doctor's appointment. And so this basically ensures that the people who are closest to the individual with the disability, who know whether or not the standing technology is actually going to provide them with the help they need, would be able to be the last word on whether or not they're going to get this assistance.
And getting back to your legislation now, does this apply just to BadgerCare? Does this affect private insurers? Who all would be affected?
So it specifically deals with people who are on BadgerCare. Mm-hmm.
Do you have your eye on possible legislation for people who receive private coverage for future legislation?
Yeah, I think that it would be a very good idea.
What is the status now of this bill on BadgerCare in the legislature?
So we just had our first committee hearing. We had a lot of really wonderful people come and testify, including individuals who currently use standing wheelchairs, and to talk about how it benefits them in their life and why it's so important to have this kind of technology available to people with disabilities. And so we're hoping to be able to get a vote through the committee so that way we can move on and get it to a vote on the floor of the Assembly.
And just from what you've heard from your colleagues, is there bipartisan support that might allow this to get passed?
Yeah, I do believe that there is bipartisan support. I know that a lot of I've been working with several of my Republican colleagues on the bill, and I know that we got a lot of Republicans and Democrats on the bill. So I think that there's a good chance of it getting through.
Talking to Representative Jimmy Anderson, Democrat representing Wisconsin's 47th Assembly District, which includes Fitchburg. We've been talking about BadgerCare legislation that would affect certain kinds of wheelchair coverage. I want to turn now, Representative Anderson, to something we've talked to you about in the past. You joined us, I think, back in July about a proposal that you were part of that would cap the price of insulin at, I think it was $100 for a 30-day supply. First of all, can you make the case for that kind of legislation?
Yeah, I mean, people with diabetes, they need insulin just like we need food and water. And the idea that we would not make it as accessible as possible is crazy. And as we've seen, insulin prices have been shooting through the roof. I mean, sometimes going up 200-400%. And what we're seeing is that I think at least a quarter of the people that use insulin end up having to ration their insulin out of fear of not being able to afford it or get it. And so I was very happy to see that the governor, in his push to try to get the legislature, including my Republican colleagues, to support various pieces of legislation, he included this insulin bill as part of his push.
Is this something you've worked, again, with Republicans on?
We reached out. Unfortunately, we didn't get any support.
So what are the next steps for this insulin legislation?
Really, it's got to be, it's up to the public. I know that we've gotten a lot of support from people that either have diabetes or know someone or love somebody that has diabetes. They've reached out to the legislature, written to their assembly people, written to their senators, and have tried to get them to move this bill in the right direction. We had a change.org petition that I think that got tens of thousands of signatures saying that this is the kind of legislation that we need in order to, in all honesty, save lives. And so I'm hoping that the people, again, keep reaching out to their assembly people, reach out to their senators and say, we need to cap the cost of insulin.
Representative Anderson, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Representative Jimmy Anderson, a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 47th Assembly District, which includes Fitchburg. He joined us to talk about a bill that would expand insurance coverage for adaptive wheelchairs. Coming up, the tensions with Iran are raising questions about the limits of presidential war powers. We'll talk to a legal expert about the push and pull between Congress and the executive branch. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. After President Trump's decision to kill Iranian military commander Qasem Soleimani with an airstrike in Iraq, some members of Congress raised concerns about not being consulted ahead of time. Democratic Senator Tim Kaine has since introduced a war powers resolution that would limit the president's ability to authorize military action against Iran. His bill has at least some Republican support in the Senate. While the Constitution gives Congress the power to declare war, the reality of who can approve the use of force and what steps they have to take to do so is a bit more complicated. Jennifer Daskal is a professor of law at American University's Washington College of Law. Jennifer, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, the Constitution, as I mentioned, gives Congress the power to declare war. But have we seen the balance between the president and Congress change over the years, putting more power in the hands of the White House?
So absolutely. So we have over time, we have seen a kind of an incremental shift in which the executive increasingly engages in a range of exercises of the use of force without getting advance congressional authorization. We've also seen ways in which old authorizations, in particular the 2001 authorization that was passed in the wake of the 9/11 attacks, and the 2002 authorization that in which Congress gave its blessing to the executive to engage in force in Iraq in an effort to oust Saddam Hussein, have been interpreted and expanded over time by the executive to authorize the use of force against groups that didn't even exist at the time that these authorizations were first enacted. And we've seen Congress acquiesce in a lot of ways to that kind of incremental expansion of executive action in this regard.
Has this been a bipartisan movement? If I'm a Democratic president, I want this authority. If I'm a Republican president, I also want this authority?
So we've seen broad assertions of executive authority to engage in actions by both Republicans and by Democrats. What's different here is what's different from the ways in which, in particular, the 2001 and 2002 authorizations to use force were interpreted by both Bush administration and the Obama administration and now the Trump administration to go against kind of groups that were deemed to be affiliated or successors to al-Qaeda, which all arguably, through at least some theory of interpretation, could be tied to the 2001 authorization to use military force. What's different here is that the president has engaged in the use of force against a leader of a nation state in a situation in which there is, among other things, has been a real risk of escalation without first going to Congress to try to get authorization with respect to the killing of Soleimani.
Have we seen precedent for that kind of action, use of force against a foreign leader without specific or without any kind of authority from Congress?
So, I mean, the president, pursuant to the president's Article 2 authority, the president has, and I think it's well recognized, the president has the authority to take action, self-defensive actions, if, in fact, there were an imminent threat to U.S. troops or to U.S. persons. What is concerning and different here is that the self-defense justifications, although they were originally articulated by the Trump administration, have increasingly been discredited by a range of reporting that's come out since, including some suggestion that this has been, you know, something that's been considered and debated for quite some time, which belies the notion that the president didn't have time to go to Congress to try to get Congress's blessing in terms of its actions here.
And when we talk about congressional blessing, does that mean the president would have to get a full vote from both chambers of Congress for that kind of imminent but not immediately imminent action, or can they do it with a certain group of congressional leaders?
So in terms of getting an authorization to use military force, in terms of making the monumental decision to engage our troops in armed conflict, the president absolutely has to go to Congress. Or should go to Congress. That's what our Constitution says. It's Congress that declares war, and it's the president that executes it. In a situation that you posited where there's some sort of imminent threat and there's a credible risk, then the president can engage unilaterally, and there's an obligation under the War Powers Resolution that he then notify Congress. And there's been practice, kind of consistent practice, that the when possible, the president would at a minimum notify some what's known as the Gang of Eight or certain leaders in Congress as well.
Talking to Jennifer Daskal, law professor at American University, looking at the use of military force and the conflict often between the president and Congress over authorization for that kind of use of force. Now, just over a week ago, the administration gave a briefing on the Soleimani killing to some senators. Republican Mike Lee of Utah, not happy with what he heard. Here's a bit of his response afterward.
Biggest thing that I found troubling from that briefing was the suggestion that, number one, they would discourage us from debating things like a War Powers Act resolution, and number two, their unwillingness to identify some point at which they would need to come to Congress to get authorization for the use of military force. I find that very troubling.
So from Senator Lee, his description of the briefing there, he's implying that the White House says they have open authority to do just about whatever they want without coming to Congress. Do you read his statement that way?
So I think what we've been hearing coming out of that briefing is that there was not a whole lot of specificity to support the claim that there was, in fact, a kind of imminent threat that would justify unilateral action. And you're starting to see some Republican senators join ranks with Democrats in saying that they will vote for a bill that would explicitly limit the president's authority to engage in the use of force against Iran without further congressional explicit authorization, with some exceptions, again, for situations in which the U.S. faces an imminent attack.
I want to give a listen to Democratic Senator Tim Kaine, who's bringing up that bill you were talking about getting a little bit of Republican support. Here he is speaking on the Senate floor.
The demand for congressional accountability is constitutionally required. In the unique constitutional framework that we have, we pledge to support and defend the principle. It's up to Congress to declare war, not the president.
Is this the kind of thing that Congress has to do if it wants to have a meaningful say in potential military future action against Iran?
Yeah, no, I think it's absolutely encouraging that Congress is now engaging. There was a resolution that passed the House. Is different than the bill that's in the Senate, because the resolution that passed the House is something known as a concurrent resolution that just has to get passed by both chambers, but it doesn't get sent up to the president, which means that it almost certainly does not have the force of law. What Senator Kaine is pushing is a bill that would then require signature by the president. That, of course, however, raises the reality that there's a significant almost certain likelihood of veto by the president. And at this point, at least, it doesn't appear as if they have a veto-proof majority in this particular case.
We're talking to Jennifer Daskal, law professor at American University, about the powers of the president to wage military action and the ability of Congress to restrict that action. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest about what each branch is legally able to do and not do? Are you worried that the U.S. president has too much leeway in using military force? Should Congress play a bigger role than it does in situations like the one with Iran? Do you support this this binding resolution we were talking about in the Senate that would limit the ability of the administration to take military action against Iran? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation about the war powers of Congress and the president with Jennifer Daskal, professor of law at American University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think there's an imbalance in who has the power to approve military force and bring the country closer to war? Should Congress have a bigger role, or is it right for the president to have a lot of leeway? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We've heard from some of you on Facebook. Janice says the founding fathers didn't want a rogue president to have that power. Jennifer, can you talk about the Constitution and what kind of limits it hoped to put on a president when it came to the ability to declare war and to take military action?
Right. So that's exactly right. So the Constitution makes the war powers a divided set of powers between Congress and the executive, and reflecting the idea that such a monumental decision to go to war is something that should be made not just by the executive, but by the branch of government that represents and is closest to the people. And so that's why the Constitution says that the Congress should declare war and the president, the executive, can execute war. Now, everybody also acknowledges that the executive can and should take actions in self-defense when there is a necessity to do so to protect the U.S. and the U.S.'s national security and U.S. troops. Over time, that understanding of when the president can act unilaterally has expanded from what was originally presumably conceived of as part of the Constitution and acted upon in our earlier history.
Yeah, along those lines, Larry on Facebook writes, presidents should be able to react to a fluid and fast-changing situation. If we're talking about an 18th century war where a country would have to mobilize an army and so forth, that's one thing. Nuclear war, the Cold War, presidents might have to act and make a decision within minutes. Did that drive some changes in this constitutional balance and laws passed in Congress?
So the constitutional balance is the same. Congress still is given the responsibility to declare war. What's happened over time, particularly in the last almost two decades since the September 11th attacks, is that Congress did pass an authorization to use force, and over time the executive has relied on that authorization in to use force in ways that were not imagined by Congress when Congress first passed the use of force, because using force against groups and entities that didn't exist at the time of the 2001 authorization. So we've seen kind of an aggrandizement in that way, and Congress failing to step in to try to take any steps to curtail that kind of executive decision making. On the other set of issues with respect to the president's ability to engage in self-defense actions, that's always been understood as an element of the commander-in-chief, the executive's authority. But we have seen broader assertions of what kinds of actions the president is entitled to engage in unilaterally.
Let's bring on a caller now. Mike is with us in Milwaukee. Mike, hello.
Yes, hello. I wanted to bring up that basically the deficiency in our system of government is that the Senate Majority Leader, as long as that leader is in lockstep with the president can pretty much do whatever he chooses or she chooses, unilaterally decide, because no resolution or law that comes onto the floor of the Senate will even be acted upon or brought up for discussion unless that Senate majority leader decides it. And if that same leader of the Senate is in lockstep with the RNC or the DNC, whichever the case may be, between those three individuals, no senator will challenge the Senate Majority Leader.
Mike, thanks for the call. Do you see, Jennifer, partisan politics getting in the way of Congress asserting its oversight role here?
So in this case, there is a mechanism to bring Senator Kaine's bill to a vote, and it will likely happen. I think there's some complications with the fact that the Senate's now, as of today, embroiled in an impeachment trial, but there's been a commitment that there will be a vote on the bill. The problem here is that the president will almost certainly veto it, and so the issue is not just the majority leader, but getting to a veto-proof majority, which requires two-thirds of the Senate.
Thanks for the call, Mike. We'll go now to Sherry in Portage. Sherry, hi.
Oh, hi. Well, I just had a question when I was listening. You said that there was no threat when President Trump took the initiative to have this man killed, but nobody is saying why he was in Iraq and what he was doing in Iraq. And it kind of brings back the whole Benghazi thing that we knew there was a threat there and we didn't act. And there was a lot of U.S. military that did get killed and citizens that did get killed. So,
Sherry, thanks for the call. I want to jump in just a minute or so left with our guest. Jennifer, the argument, and we've heard indications from the White House, they say at least Soleimani was involved in potentially imminent attacks.
Right. So, I mean, a couple of things. One, we know that Soleimani was dangerous. He was a dangerous individual, and he was engaged in a whole range of disturbing actions. That said, the question here is not whether Iran posed kind of a grander threat, because in those situations, that's exactly when the executive should go to Congress and ask for an authorization if, in fact, there is a decision to use force against Iranian forces. The issue is whether or not there was, in fact, the kind of imminent threat that would justify and the president to use force in this way without going to Congress. And then there's a separate set of questions and separate about engagement internationally as well. And here we initially heard some claims by the executive that there was an imminent threat, and over time, those don't appear to be backed up. And in the briefing to the Senate, that has led to some Republicans joining support for a bill that would restrict the use of force against Iran.
And we'll watch the progress of that bill. Thanks to Jennifer Daskal, law professor at American University, looking at military power, the use of military force, Congress, and the president. More people are being locked up in Wisconsin, and the increase in inmates in the state's jails and prisons is costing taxpayers more money. A new analysis of state data by WPR found significant increases in jail populations since 2015. Rob Menser has details.
During a recent tour of the Oneida County Jail, a man who'd just been booked was there coming down from the drugs he'd been using. Jail staff had him in restraints, and the man could be heard calling out.
Let's head this way first. On something. They're keeping a close eye on that.
It's not rare for people who get booked in the jail to have medical needs. Jails have become used to dealing with people who are facing withdrawals from opiates or the lingering effects of methamphetamines. Oneida County Sheriff Grady Hartman says dealing with the effects of drug addiction has become the norm.
4 or 5 years ago, I never really thought we would have, our community up here in the Northwoods would have a lot of methamphetamine and heroin use. I never thought we would have overdose deaths.
The increase in inmate population has put a strain on many local jails. The number of jails placing inmates in other counties has been steadily rising in recent years. In the first half of last year, more than 40 jails typically had inmates in other facilities.
We built the facility in 98. And then in 2009, we started to outgrow the facility.
That's Sheboygan County Sheriff Corey Raisler talking about Sheboygan's detention center. It regularly exceeds its recommended population of inmates, and that can force some difficult decisions.
We just don't have enough single cell space in order to accommodate those needs when people come in off the street and they're under the influence of some intoxicant or drug, or they might have a medical and mental health issue, but which would preclude them from being placed in the general population.
During a tour, Brinkman says some of those inmates do end up housed with others in a less secure area of the jail.
And this area of the facility fills up faster than we'd like it to, so we're forced.
Governor Tony Evers campaigned on a promise to cut the state's prison population in half. A report from the state showed that it grew by about 8% from 2011 to 2018. Reversing that trend was always going to be a challenge, and there's little evidence of progress. In fact, state prisons are so overloaded that the state regularly pays county jails to take inmates. Oneida County, which has more space than it needs in its detention facility, contracts with the state to take about 100 prisoners at a time. Sheriff Hartman says Oneida County officials drive a four-hour round trip from Rhinelander to Stanley, Wisconsin, every week to exchange inmates. But he says in many ways, the state prisoners are easier to manage.
As headaches go with inmates, we have significantly far less headaches with a state inmate than we do with a county inmate.
The county also earns about $1.2 million per year from the state in exchange for providing housing. The money goes to the county's capital budget. Legislative efforts to reduce the jail population haven't gained steam in the state capital. But Milwaukee Democratic Representative David Crowley is one of a group of legislators focused on the issue. He's introduced a bill to limit bail jumping charges, which are used to incarcerate someone who's violated a court order, for example, drinking alcohol if a judge has ordered them not to, as a separate case proceeds through the court system. In 2018, more than 8,000 people in Wisconsin were charged with felony bail jumping. Crowley says someone can be found not guilty of the original charge, but still be prosecuted for violating an order like that.
But because you were guilty of bail jumping, now you're doing even more time than the original charge.
Crowley's proposal has bipartisan support, but it's not clear that will be enough to get it a vote. Earlier this month, Governor Evers called a set of Democratic proposals a first step toward criminal justice reform. The next day, a group of Republicans announced a legislative package they called, quote, tougher on crime initiatives. Those bills would increase some penalties. Rob Mentzer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, an age discrimination case is before the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll look at the current state of affairs when it comes to age-based discrimination in the workplace. Add some Korean flavors to your home cooking. We'll find out how on this week's edition of Food Friday. And it's the future today in a Wisconsin college class that's using cutting-edge virtual reality technology. Is it the cyberpunk world come to life? Probably not. That's coming up tomorrow on Central Time.